Today's AI Talks is recorded live at the Engelsberg Seminar 2023, a gathering of global authorities discussing the theme of leadership and statecraft. And it's being held in a very sunny, very hot Sweden. And we are delighted to welcome our guest, Fredrik Lögevall, into our very cool studio. Fredrik is the Lawrence D. Belfer Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University, and he's working on the second volume of his biography of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now, one of the words I really hate using about in any other context other than Byzantine portraiture is iconic. But I think if there is a 20th century politician who has the status of iconic, I think it's probably John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And I wonder, Fredrik, why does he still have such a powerful hold over the public imagination?
Well, first off, it's great to be with you. I'm delighted to have a chance to chat with you about this project. And, I'm reflecting on your question as I go, and I have been since I started this project close to a decade ago, I guess. What is it about Kennedy, 60 years after his assassination, that he still, as you say, has this hold on the American imagination, to some extent even beyond the United States? I think it's, surprise, surprise, I guess it's a combination of things as I see it. That is to say, I think it has something to do with his youthful good looks and his dignified bearing. I think it has something to do with the fact that he became a very inspirational speaker. He wasn't, by the way, at the start of his career, a particularly good speaker, but through hard work, he became one. I think it has something to do with the glamour of the of his White House, Camelot, as it became called, after the fact. And then probably also the circumstances surrounding his death. I think there is something about not only the fact that he was assassinated, seemingly in the prime of his life, in his mid-40s, but that it was captured on film. And we can see that film again and again and again. I think all those things matter, but I also want to say what I think is maybe more important in the end in terms of your question, why he continues to have this hold on us. I think it has something to do with his faith in his country. Sounds a little trite to say, but I think it's really true. A belief in what America represented, a belief in the importance of thinking beyond oneself, which is a lesson he got from his parents. Very complicated couple. We can talk about Joe and Rose, but they did instill in their kids this idea that you've been given something special here. You've got privilege. Do something with this. And in a certain way, I think Kennedy was able to almost to the country at large say, what are you going to do? And of course, the immortal words of his inaugural address, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. That still resonates.
And that's available on YouTube
For
anyone who wants to see that. And there is, I suppose, the impression you get seeing that inaugural address, any footage of Kennedy, even his death, is that he's forever young.
It's really true, isn't it? It's so true. The Kennedy speeches that one can see there, and of course other politicians too, but we're focusing on him, you get a sense, I think, in watching them and in watching his press conferences, very famous press conferences, which drew the viewership, you know, tens of millions of viewers would watch these press conferences. You see here a politician who could connect with people in a very powerful way, never more so than in that inaugural address.
One question that arises on this is, seeing as his life is so well documented in word and in vision as well, there must be challenges for a biographer today on someone who is so well known, who is so well documented, with such an iconic figure, to use that direct word. I mean, what are the challenges there?
Well, that is a challenge. The fact that literally thousands of books have been written about Kennedy. And I knew that going in. What am I going to say? What am I going to add to what we already know? But it hit me. It didn't take me long to realize this, that though we have mounds and mounds of books on this political figure and on his family, on the Kennedys, We have remarkably few biographies, and we can get into why that's the case. But the point is, that is to say, true or let's say comprehensive biographies that look closely at Kennedy using the available archival evidence. And as you suggest, it's vast. The amount of source material is incredible. But using that material, using the other evidence that we have at our disposal, oral histories, newspapers, obviously secondary accounts, memoirs, using all of this to paint a portrait, to describe this individual, very few such studies, and even more, or maybe I should say even less, even fewer books that try to do what I think a biographer must do, which is to place the subject of the biography in his or her time and place, give a sense of the history, give a sense, in this case, of what it was like in mid-century America to come of political age, to rise to the top of the political ladder, a sense also of world politics in this remarkable period. To my knowledge, or to not to my knowledge, to my sense is nobody, with all due respect to all the authors who came before, nobody has really done this. That's what I'm attempting to do in these two volumes.
That's what struck me about Volume 1 that made it so fresh and interesting to me, is that it was the first book of its kind. Yeah, it's a long time since Robert Dallek's Unfinished Life. And this is a very different kind of book. Why hasn't it been attempted before?
You know, it's a good question. Nigel Hamilton started to do this. So Nigel's plan, and I know him, he lives in Boston part of the year, so we see each other. His plan was to write a 3-volume biography. And he produced one called Reckless Youth, which took the story from Kennedy's birth basically to the end of World War II, or maybe 1946 when he's running for Congress. And then for various reasons we won't go into here, Nigel decided not to pursue that project. I puzzle over your question. I think part of the answer, but it's only part, is that publishers, at least historically, have loved Kennedy books. They're very quick to sign Kennedy books. They don't demand a great deal from the author of these Kennedy books. And they're often quickie books. They're not without value. I don't mean to disparage all of these books. But they're books that I think are written fairly fast. And you get a nice advance, a nice payday for producing this book. And very often they repeat the same anecdotes that are thinly sourced. And you see the same stories told again and again and again. It's not a very good answer to your question. I think maybe another partial answer is that people assume, as I did, oh, surely this has been done. We don't need another biography because there must be so many of them. And then you realize they don't. They're not there. And as you say, Bob Dallek's book is now slightly over 20 years old. It's a different kind of a book than the one I'm attempting to do here. But it's a bit of a puzzle, frankly.
And we're of a generation, I suppose, the three of us, who will have grown up in the shadow of JFK. Yeah. He's very familiar. But thinking about 60 years, there will be plenty of undergraduates, postgraduates, who will be far more distant in terms of that resonance, that shadow that he leaves there. Did that affect the way you wrote that book, that somehow it's the first one for a generation that didn't really know him, even in that comic trail?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a good observation on your part. Yeah, I think so. I think I want this to be, you know, Kennedy for a new generation. I want it to be life and times biography, if I can use that phrase, people of all ages, but in particular, perhaps for those who, as you say, are now much too young to have all but the most fleeting connection with him. Most people, I think, even young people, will be aware of the assassination. Mm-hmm. They've probably seen the Zapruder film, or at least a portion of the Zapruder film. They may have a general sense about the fact that, you know, he was heavily involved in Vietnam. They'll know something from high school history about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah, yeah. They'll know something about Jackie, maybe something about his philandering. So there are these little snippets that I think a great many Americans and people elsewhere of all ages will have. But as you say, beyond that, they will know very little. And so I'm hoping, in a sense, to bring this remarkable American life. It's the great American story in some ways. I'm hoping to bring it to, as you say, a new generation of readers.
The point about him, the point that you made in your talk here earlier at Engelsberg about JFK, the point about him is his seriousness. That's your contention, that he's a serious leader for a serious time. Of course, he had his critics, but he contrasts with the current generation of leaders.
I do think he does. And maybe it's partly the era. In other words, if you were to pick other figures from his time, let's take the other contenders for the 1960 Democratic nomination. Hubert Humphrey, very serious public servant, thought a lot about the issues of the day, was committed maybe in particular to civil rights, was very pro-labor and pro-union, but I would consider Hubert Humphrey as meeting this seriousness test that I suggested in my talk. I think you could say the same about Stuart Symington, little remembered today, but a serious public servant. Lyndon Johnson, of course, wanted that nomination. Adlai Stevenson, who had twice been the nominee, 52 and 56, believe it or not, was still kind of hoping that he could get it in 60. And I would even say that Richard Nixon, Vice President of the United States, whatever one might want to say about Nixon, he approached the job of being vice president and then candidate for president and ultimately later on president. I think he took the job seriously. And so I don't in any way mean to suggest that Kennedy was unique in his time. But I think what you're suggesting, or what I would certainly concur with, is that in our own day, yes, there are some people who think about their public duty in this way, in this very serious way, dedicate themselves to it, to being informed, to being dispassionate, to putting the country first, not their own self-interest first. For a complicated set of reasons, I'm sure, we have fewer such people today. And I think we're in desperate need of that leadership that Kennedy represented.
Can I ask an unserious question, a question about Kennedy's style? I don't necessarily mean his style of speaking, although that's partly wrapped up in that. I mean his dress sense, the way in which he's perfectly dressed in pretty much every occasion from about the age of 18, 19 onwards. And by the time he becomes president, that look is established. I mean, it's just something which is so fresh at the time and continues to fascinate so many people. Where does it come from? Because I've always thought that, and it's not an original observation. Lots of historians have said that with Nixon versus Kennedy, remember that famous clash in 1960, is that we think of Kennedy as the politician who was made over, who was stylized by some outside influence, smartened up, or someone who knew how to dress him. But actually, really, it was the other way around. It was Nixon who was the first true television contender, because they had to take this slightly awkward, ungainly guy and try to put him into a neater suit. And then, of course, it goes wrong. Famous story in the TV debates, whether it's true or not, about Nixon, you know, not having shaved. But with Kennedy, all they had to do was stop him wearing a hat. All you had to say was, hats are not really going to be a big thing in the 1960s, so don't wear a hat. But the suits and everything, the Kennedy look, the leisure wear, all that stuff we're familiar with of him hanging out in the Kennedy compound, where does that come from? Is that completely natural to him? Or is it just part of his background? Was it just the stores they went to? Or was it just his personal sense of style?
Well, it's an interesting question, because when he's at university at Harvard, he was famous for wearing, you know, unmatched socks and for his shirt tail hanging out and for not giving much attention to his attire. He was not any kind of fashion plate walking around the Harvard campus.
But it's still quite, it's untidy preppy.
There's an innate sense of style that I think he has even then. You see it to some degree also in that first campaign in 1946, when he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's not a particularly effective speaker, but he looks in some way the part. I also, however, want to point out that I think Jackie is really interesting in this regard, because when they get married in 53, and in fact, even in 52, when they begin to date in a serious way, she basically says, Jack, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but Jack, your wardrobe is fine, but we're going to make it better. And she begins to, in a sense, educate him about what cut of shirt will go the best with this kind of suit and what tie you should wear with this particular jacket. The shoe choice, which he comes to believe is really critical. Shoes make the man. Some of that, I think, comes from Jackie in a very interesting way. But he does then develop his own sensibility, preference for navy blue, preference for the single vent in terms of the jacket. And it's, as you say, part of who he is in our minds. There's also one other thing to say here, though, about the broader issue you raise. There's a sense which he gets partly from his father. Let's remember that his dad was a Hollywood mogul in the 20s. Joe Kennedy begins to preach to Jack at an early point that image, Jack, matters. We're going to present you to the voters of Massachusetts, and then later to the national audience. We're going to present you in a certain way, and you're going to have to be comfortable in the glare of the camera lights. You're going to have to be comfortable on television. This whole television is a game changer. Joe Kennedy understands. I think that's on some level wrapped up in what Kennedy becomes, what he represents. And it's connected to this style question in some way.
And style in that intensely visual world that's becoming even more visual is an essential to it. I mean, you could argue it's always been there. Look at the Tudor monarchy or something, you know. Although saying that reminds me again as well that John is not the direct heir. And that's maybe an important fact. But in terms of the style and substance, when style and substance are put together, that's the perfect pairing. And there is that real substance to him. And I thought about, for example, the Apollo program, the idea of landing man on the moon, again, another famous quote. And you talk about an America that he represents and leads, which is one of immense competence. From Roosevelt onwards, this country can solve problems. You know, any problem seems within its grasp to solve.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And here one could make the interesting, to me at least, comment that here in Sweden, where we now sit, my parents, who have both passed, my parents talked about how Kennedy and his country were perceived in the early 1960s. And it's exactly as you say, that this is America. This is the leader of the free world. This is, in a sense, our leader. This is, in a sense, our president. I think my parents, on some level, thought of John F. Kennedy as their president, too, because this is a country, as you say, that can accomplish anything, that can do whatever it sets its mind to do. Look what it accomplished in World War II, after it entered the war. And of course, the Russians, my father in particular, knew his history, and he knew that the Red Army in the East was absolutely vital. But there's still a sense on the part of my parents, and I think a great many Swedes of that generation, that, as you say, this is America. And John F. Kennedy, with his speeches, which were often played in Sweden, the inaugural address was translated, his book Profiles in Courage, which he wrote in 1956, not only came out in a Swedish edition, but sold extremely well in Sweden, even when he's just a senator. There's already a sense in 1956-57 that this is somebody we want to know about, on some level maybe even emulate. It's a remarkable, it seems to me, testimony to what the United States was in the middle decades of the 20th century, and maybe in particular what Kennedy represented.
Shall we for a moment consider the charge sheet against him? I'll be absolutely honest here and say that Volume 1 had a very powerful effect on me, and I'd long been a Kennedy skeptic. I must say I prefer, if that's a word, ironically really, LBJ, just the guts of getting stuff done, just the political capacity, the deal-making, they're not necessarily all of the specific policy. It all goes wrong in the end, of course, and it's its own kind of tragedy, isn't it, the LBJ experience. But your book did change my thinking about JFK. But there is a charge sheet against him from his critics, the space program. I don't necessarily share this view. I'm a big fan of the Apollo program and everything that goes with it for the reasons you describe in the describe in your work. But did it really deliver the extraordinary cost of it? If you look at the trajectory of the space program in the 70s and the 80s, it was a program, a nationalized space program that virtually ran out of road. And it's only now being rediscovered, revivified by the private sector. So the sort of national approach was a kind of dead end, maybe, initiated by Kennedy. He made some foreign policy miscalculations, though ultimately he's right and very clever in how he handles Cuba. And then he gets bogged down on civil rights, trying to do the right thing, but it doesn't really work. But we're getting into Volume 2 territory. How do you, as someone who thinks that he was a great president, how do you respond to those who have that critique of him?
I should comment just briefly on your last point. I'm not sure that I would say that John F. Kennedy was a great president. I certainly would not put him in the pantheon of you know, the big three. That is to say, Washington, Lincoln, and FDR. For one thing, he didn't live long enough to warrant inclusion in that group. I would, however, say that he had greatness within, that there was a capacity there, and had he lived and run for re-election, which he was certainly going to do, had he won that re-election, which I think he would have, that great things could have been in store. But you're right, there is a charge sheet against, and I'm going to be, I hope, forthright about that in the second volume. I think there were policy mistakes. I do not, and I've written about his Vietnam policies in the past, and I don't think I'm going to revise substantially my assessment of his Vietnam policies for this volume, but it's not a very favorable analysis of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Though on the counterfactual, what would he have done had he lived? There I come down on the side suggesting that if he had lived, he would have avoided the kind of large-scale escalation that Johnson embarked upon. But Vietnam, I don't give him high marks on. On civil rights, I think he was slow. I think partly for reasons of political calculation and his need for Southern support, perceived need at least, to maintain the support of Southerners in Congress, he moved slowly. He does come around in 62 and especially in 63, I think for genuine reasons, and comes to see this as a moral issue for the country in a genuine way, partly because of his brother's encouragement. But yes, civil rights, a problematic record, let's say. Cuba as well is mixed, as you say. The missile crisis, I think, as have many others, I think it is a remarkable moment. It is his finest hour. And I think the evidence, some of which is pretty fresh, only underscores, at least for me, the degree to which we can all be grateful that John F. Kennedy was president in those tense days in October of 1962. But more broadly, Cuba... Yeah. A problem, because even after the missile crisis, he continues efforts to destabilize the Castro government in ways that I think were counterproductive then and certainly look counterproductive in hindsight.
You suggested in your talk earlier that you think that the course of the Cold War, I'm paraphrasing, could have been quite different if he'd lived. You think in a second term he'd have taken a different route?
I do. And I hope to be able to develop that point. To some extent, there is... what should I call it? Conjecture, inference in my intention to lay out that argument. In other words, I don't necessarily have firm evidence for some of this, but I believe that in his last year of life, in the last year of his life, and even to some degree before, say, the Cuban Missile Crisis, he saw that the superpower relationship needed to change, that it could change. I think he had a willing partner in Khrushchev after the missile crisis. So you see real steps in 63 to that end. The American University speech, the anniversary of it was just the other day, is one of his great speeches, in which he talks about precisely a new international environment, a new relationship between Moscow and Washington. And I think he was taking steps to realize that vision. I think he would have done so. He would have deepened that effort had he lived, and maybe in particular after being reelected. Because let's remember, all Democrats in the Cold War had to worry about charges of being so-called soft on communism. So he had to worry, because he was a politician first, he had to worry about how Republicans would respond if he moved too quickly. But I think he was intent on doing so, and I believe had he lived, he would have taken those steps.
Where do you place Kennedy ideologically? I mean, it seems to me, tell me if I'm wrong here, that you're trying to reclaim him for the center, for the broad center. So if he had lived, American politics in the, of course, it's divided in the early 60s, but by the politics of the mid to late decade becoming increasingly divided, the left is becoming more and more agitated, radicalized. It's the era of student protest, all sorts of student change. Would Kennedy, no matter, you know, how cool he was, we talked earlier about his sense of personal style, would Kennedy have been broken by that process, or would he have shaped American politics and taken it in a different direction, do you think?
I think he could have taken it in a different direction. I have to answer with some hesitation, because some of the forces that you've just described, or the roots of some of these developments, are there, I think, really already in the 1950s. They're certainly there in the early 60s, in other words, while Kennedy is still alive. So we would have seen some of this agitation even under a surviving Kennedy. But the war is important in much of this. And I do believe, as I suggested earlier, that we would have avoided a large-scale American war in the jungles of Southeast Asia had John F. Kennedy survived. And because he had support, including from across the aisle among ordinary Americans, which is an interesting thing about him that I didn't mention in my talk today, but the degree to which Republicans supported John F. Kennedy, not just Democrats, his centrism, and I think you're absolutely right about my view of him, which is I think he's very much in the center of the Democratic Party. And given his charisma and his inspirational speech making, I think there is that opportunity for him in the later 60s to help the country steer clear, to avoid some of these divisions. He's a very interesting case in that he is deeply suspicious of extremes. He talks about this. Extremes on both his left in the Democratic Party and extremes on the right in the Republican Party. He talks often about political courage. He even has a book called Profiles in Courage. The courage that he most admires, that he most respects, is the courage of moderates who resist the extremes. And I think that's a pretty telling attribute or a telling aspect of his political persona, that he really does believe that it's in the center, even as he's a committed Democrat. I don't buy the argument that some have made, which is John F. Kennedy is a conservative. On some issues, on fiscal policy, for example, he's quite conservative.
Yeah.
But broadly speaking, he's in the mainstream, I would say, of the Democratic Party in the 1960s. But he's never comfortable with what he sees as extremists in either party.
On taxation, for example, he's sometimes cited by conservatives for his views on tax.
And one of the things that's really striking about JFK, short-lived president, of course, is that although his life was short, his language leaves on. He was a great rhetorician. And in fact, as you point out, you know, there's many, many examples of rhetoric that we could pull out. But one of those things, I mean, even in death, he was a rhetorician, the final speech that was supposed to be spoken.
Yeah.
Those words unsaid in Dallas. In November 1963.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, that one about the absolute, the vital importance of fact-based, reasoned discourse. And there are other examples of this where he insisted on that, where he, in a sense, anticipated the moment we're now in. And in those remarks, which I quoted from today at the end of my remarks, that he never got a chance to deliver at the Dallas Trade Mart. Just, it was going to be maybe a half hour or an hour after he was gunned down. Speak with such power to me about this moment and how, in a sense, he anticipated where we were going to be as a country 60 years after his death. I think it's worth mentioning, since we haven't already, that in Ted Sorensen, who was his principal speechwriter, together the two of them formed one of the most extraordinary political partnerships in all of American history. And so when we think about Kennedy as a master of rhetoric, political rhetoric, we need to acknowledge that Sorensen did so much to make this happen. What would typically happen is that JFK would say, "Ted, come in here." And then Kennedy would tell Sorensen, "I want a speech in which we make the following points." Sorensen would go away, would hammer out this speech. They would come back. He would come back. The two of them would then make tweaks together. Kennedy became very good at making extemporaneous changes even while he's delivering a speech, which I think is an amazing skill he had. He could speak, for example, in Berlin in 1963. Much of that extraordinary speech in Berlin was ad-libbed. If you look at the text that he had before him and you compare it to what you can listen to, they're quite different. And he could speak in full paragraphs even when he's departing from his text. Nevertheless, I do feel compelled to comment on Sorensen, who's going to be occupying, therefore, a very important part of my second volume. He's there in the first volume, but especially in the second. And he probably doesn't quite get his due as a wordsmith, as somebody who understood the way Kennedy wanted to speak. It's a remarkable relationship.
Do you think those around him, because we talk about the court, we talk about this Camelot,
yeah,
you know, those, I'll use the word again, iconic photographs of them, yeah, all together, you know, yeah, looking at scripts, everything else. Do you think he had that level of, his qualities as a team player were important, that he was a leader of a group, not just the nation, that there was an intimate managerialism there? Was he good at that?
I think he was good at that. Again, you know, as we've said a couple times today, a few times, he certainly had shortcomings. And so I don't want this to appear as a sort of hagiographic assessment. But you do put your finger on another one of his skills, which is one that I think, by the way, LBJ lacked. With disastrous consequences, because I think it affected how things developed in Vietnam. But Kennedy was very good, not only at managing a small team, but at listening. One of the people today on my panel talked about the importance of being able to listen, and I think Kennedy had that. Mm-hmm. A kind of curiosity about the world and about other people's opinions that I think really served him well. And not just a tolerance for dissenting opinions, but in a sense wanting to hear counterarguments to whatever was being proposed. Time and again, maybe especially in foreign policy, but also in domestic policy, we see this both in the tapes, because some White House meetings were taped beginning in 1962, but also in transcripts, in oral histories, that Kennedy is probing, that he is soliciting, that he's listening, that he's respectful. And I think there's no question that in a great many instances, it served the policymaking process well.
You're very pessimistic about, yeah, the modern American political situation. Yeah. What lessons do you think there are that could be learned from the Kennedy administration and the culture that was that was created there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like I think it's hopeless. It's not. As I suggested today in my talk, though I'm originally Swedish, I'm now also an American citizen, and I'm ultimately, I think, hopeful, even maybe optimistic about the country. not in the short and medium term. I think we're in the most serious political crisis in America that we've had since the Civil War. And so I think it's an acute situation in many ways that we are in. And I think what's called for is for some means of getting Americans to understand that the things that they have in common are more important than what divide them. That government, though it can't solve all our problems, government has an essential role to play. That we've got to place trust, not only in institutions, but trust in one another. And I think in all of these areas, we've lost a great deal, and that concerns me deeply. I do think politicians of the past, like John F. Kennedy, and also there are others we could talk about. I think Franklin Roosevelt represents a great many things that we can look to in terms of an ability to speak to all Americans and somehow get them to understand that this extraordinary thing called the American idea, which is extraordinary, and I can say that as a Swede coming from a different country, that, you know, when I heard the judge in the Tompkins County courthouse, you know, swear all of us in as citizens of the United States. This is in upstate New York, 2008. He was just powerfully moving when he talked about the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. I think if I could get that judge to speak to the nation in ways that I think in some ways echo what John F. Kennedy talked about, then I think we could begin to repair this in a way that I think ultimately we need to do is if this great American experiment is to survive. As I said, I think it will, I think it can, but it's going to require important political leadership.
When can we expect Volume 2?
So I've got good momentum, I'm happy to tell both of you. But you know, life intervenes, one has to teach, one has committee work, one travels to Sweden occasionally. I think that if I'm able to make the progress that I anticipate, that I have 18 months to complete the second volume, which of course will take, it's going to be a longish book, shall we say, but it'll take the story to the end, to Dallas, 1963. And then, of course, I want to write about his legacy and talk about what he means for us today. 18 months. The publisher will then take, as you both know, will take 9 months, maybe 12 months. So maybe 2.5 years before we see it.
Yeah, well, we can't wait, I'm sure.
Looking forward to it. Much.
Agree. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was fantastic. Thank you very much. Thank you.